Hi and welcome. My name is Lawrence and I'm this week's bi-weekly interview host. As you can see or hear, I'm not joined by my colleagues because they are on a well-deserved holiday. However, I'm joined by a very special guest today and I can quickly introduce him. So first of all, thank you so much for joining us, Freddie.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let me introduce you to him. So Freddie Murr, he has served as an intelligence officer and he is currently working at the Nordic Financial Cert in Norway as the senior threat intelligence analyst, where he serves over 200 financial institutions in the Nordics with threat intelligence. And through so he does this through reports, analysis and industry networking. So he can also talk about this more later. But aside from this, he's also an expert in intelligence, especially open source intelligence. And today we are going to talk about his intelligence architecture map that he created and that I also came across a couple of weeks, which is truly fascinating. It's very, very interesting. But before we talk about this, let me ask you the first question. So this is a question we ask everyone, namely, tell us your story. So how did you get into open source intelligence how did you start?
Sure. It's a long story, but I'm going to try and keep it as short and sweet as I can. So my background basically is 15 years of sales and marketing. That's where I started, way back. I'm 48 years now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's been a few years. Yeah. In 2006, I started to do education and stuff. I was old. I was 30 plus something when I started to go back to school. In 2011, I was doing my bachelor's degree in marketing. In Norway, we had our, big, terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. So there was one dude who blew up a building, a government building in Oslo Central, and then he went out to an island and killed in total of 77 people on those two incidents. And a lot of them were kids. Mm-hmm. So that sort of got me into the hold of, it certainly got me mad. And, why do people do stuff like this? And I wanted to learn more of how can I identify what's going on and then what can I do with it afterwards? So basically that got me to the whole idea of working on counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. So I went to Scotland and took a master's degree in counterterrorism at University of St. Andrews. Oh, nice. And once I was done with it, I thought, well, this is great, but I now know about the radicalization process. I simply don't know enough about what am I going to do with it? So I simply turned around that year and said, okay, I'm going to do another master's degree. So I went straight to London and went on King's College London. And there I did a master's degree in intelligence with a focus on cybersecurity. Both of my masters were working on how terrorists are using technology or critical infrastructure to hurt the society. And the last one at King's, I also focused on how are terrorists using technology to hide their tracks and try to not be discovered, basically. So that sort of gave me the answers I needed to do. And then I went into the army and worked on army intelligence, of course. Mm-hmm. And there I worked in a field of open source and OSINT. That was sort of my field when I was working in single source. And I've been doing it ever since. In a couple of years back, I went out into the private sector. Mm-hmm. Now I work in cybersecurity. And basically work with protecting financial institutions in the Nordics from, not evildoers, but, bad people who try to steal money or disrupt payment systems, etc. So on organized crimes, insider threats and nation states, basically. So the whole mapping of it. Yeah, that's my short story, but it's complex.
it is complex. You see, this is the thing, like everyone has a very unique, complex story. But at the end of the day, what really sparks this, this journey is always curiosity. My career path is pretty not similar. Yeah, similar in the sense that also the interest in counterterrorism, especially understanding, how terrorists use the internet and technology, and also sparked by events, special events. It's always really interesting to hear how you moved on. And you did your two masters at King's and St. Andrews. Really, really interesting. And can you maybe also a little bit tell us more about, how the, an average day looks like as a threat intelligence officer, what you do as an analyst
Today, yeah, sure. So basically what I do most of my time, since I'm not a technical person, my background isn't technology in the sense of working with malware analysis or coding or anything like that. My specialty is intelligence and the process of intelligence and how to work with and build basically and manage a whole program of how to do intelligence. So what I work mostly with are on strategic level, and I work on the larger topics, topics that takes more time to work on. So in cybersecurity or CTI, cyber mm-hmm. threat intelligence, most of the people that I work with or worked with in the last couple of years are working on incidents. And incidents are like ever-changing. Stuff happens all the time. So that means they have to be on the ball around the clock and have to be available, have to fix and have to deal and have to stop every type of attack that's going on. I have more time. I work more on the long-term strategic decision support where you have board members or the C-suite or managers that are asking long-term questions of, we are going to invest in this type of technology. What type of education do our people need? Or what type of technology do we need in the future? What type of threats will likely or most likely hit us in the future? What will the threat landscape look like? What is the threat landscape today based on what we've seen lately? And what are the trends and developments? Those are the type of questions I work with. So most of my time is identifying stakeholders, identifying their needs, identifying our resources internally available to us over the year. What do we then have of questions from our stakeholders, and what can we do with the resources, i.e. what type of products and services can we then deliver that delivers value to the stakeholders at the end of the year. So that's basically my whole process of stakeholders, they have needs, I have resources, I then have products and services I have to manage over time. Mm-hmm. And then I have to figure out how can I build yearly threat assessment report, quarterly threat assessment reports, weekly, monthly updates of threat landscape and trends and developments, continuous work that goes on every day that feeds up to the weekly, feeds up to the monthly and quarterly and yearly. So basically I work around the clock and monitoring and tracking.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, you know, it's online, it's OSINT, it's open source.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on, as you just described. So you're not only doing, you know, the data collection online and try to analyze it and, you know, put it together and understand what the current threat landscape is. You also try to forecast what's going to happen in, you know, in a quarter, in 3, 4, 5, 6 years, maybe. You know, for someone who is new in this OSINT field and wants to do something similar, you know, what kind of skills do these people need in order to work in this environment?
So in cyber, there's a lot of skills people could come in with. So for me, I had no technical background at all. I had technical understanding, but not, you know, as I said, I have never written any code or analyzed any malware and or logs for that matter, right? So from my perspective, I came from academia and also from knowledge of how to do intelligence well. So that's sort of, you know, my sort of way in, and that's my platform. And I've seen people that are coming, and most of the people I know and work doesn't have a formal education. They have a keen interest. They love working on problems. They love to figure out how can I get access to that data and how can I make that data actually answer the questions I try to answer. And, you know, and I think that interest, that level of commitment, that curiosity, I think that's the key, where you're more than just the piece of paper and the grade you got from your bachelor's or your master's degree. You're living the skill set that you have and the work that you want to do. And I think that's sort of what differentiates those who are educated and those who are really well suited for the task, because they have a keen interest outside of work. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's a famous saying, you know, I'm going to butcher this, but, you know, if you do your hobby, you know, and you enjoy your hobby, you're not going to work a day in your life, because that's basically your work now. You're having fun doing it. And I think that's an important thing to take into account there, because certainly I do. I have a lot of fun what I do, and I live and breathe it, and I have fun with it on my spare time. You know, this is this, for instance, like it to me is building, you know, knowledge and building networks and building understanding. So I think that's the most important part.
This is exactly, you know, what we all say at Ozen Curious. It's the curiosity, and you know, as you just described, building this knowledge and learning constantly is key. Also in my field, if I just stop doing anything for like 3-4 months, everything is moving so quickly. It takes another 4 or 5 months to get back into it, you know, to understand the threat landscape, to understand where to look for, you know, these certain individuals or groups. And it takes a lot of work, but also at the same time, technology is constantly evolving and there are new tools that you can use. And I don't want to just talk about tools, because I think there's this misconception that, you know, it's about OSINT tools and OSINT techniques. They are very important and they have their place, absolutely. But it's not just about these tools. It's more than that. And I think you already touched upon it when you described your work, when you talk to stakeholders. And this is the first step, you know, getting the requirements or understanding what they actually need or what the problem is or the question. And I think we can also, this makes sense to now move on to the next bit, which is the main bit of this interview. So this is maybe also a story for our listeners of how I found out about Freddy. So I heard from Zevin on Discord. He was talking, he told me about you and your intelligence architecture map. And I was very curious. So I clicked on it, and there's also an article. And let me just show you where you can find it. So if you go to Freddy's GitHub page, that's github.com/ERUM/Intel Architecture Map. So I repeat, that's github.com/ERUM/Intel Architecture Map. And you're going to find a PDF version of this architecture map. And Freddy is going to walk us through of what it is and what exactly the rationale was behind this map. But I found it really, really fascinating and very in-depth in terms of explaining the entire process that goes into producing intelligence or open source intelligence. So let me just throw back to you, like, what is the intelligence architecture map?
So the Intel architecture map is basically a way for me, when I started this at least, for me to depict the complexities of how to do intelligence well. So when people talk about cyber threat intelligence, they talk about threat intelligence. They're talking about OSINT, which is open source intelligence. There's a huge gap of knowledge when it comes to the word intelligence. They think that open source is all about, you know, gathering all the data or mapping out some sort of infrastructure. And then, you know, I broke down this paywall and I got the information. And now I know and I can read all this data. And that's cool. But at the end of the day, there's some sort of customer. And that customer needs your data and your report in a tangible way where they can actually use it for something. So basically, intelligence is decision support. And there needs to be some requirement with a decision behind it. And the decision, usually there's a question. Usually it's one question, and it's, you know, it's not double barreled. And also, you know, it's supporting a single decision. That's usually the minimum requirements in having intelligence.
Absolutely. Sorry to interrupt, but this is such a very important point, decision support, because sometimes, or often actually, I get asked the question of, you know, how can I find stories? How can I, you know, how can I find these amazing, you know, OSINT? Basically, they want to publish some very OSINT-y reports or anything that happened worldwide, or, you know, something very interesting. And then I think there's this, as you just said, and I think that the problem here is with finding these stories is to understand that OSINT is basically used, you know, is given to decision makers to act upon it. So you have to start with something. You have to understand, first of all, the landscape and generate questions. So if someone has no decision maker to support but wants to, you know, find something of interest that he or she wants to report on, first needs to find the question. And then it starts the entire intelligence cycle.
Oh, absolutely, and we can certainly dive into, you know, the whole the steps of it. And when I went into cyber threat intelligence a couple of years back, and you know, to me it was like these guys are talking my language. You know, that they're saying, you know, stakeholders are using threat intelligence. They're using decision. They're using all these right words on how to work with cyber threat intelligence. And I was like, yeah, I come from intelligence. You know, these are my people. They understand me. I understand them. But as I sort of started to discuss with vendors and talking with cyber threat intelligence experts, and when we discuss topics of intelligence, they're like, oh, well, we have this confidence level, and, you know, we're certain at this level. And they were talking the talk. But when I started to dive into, oh, that's cool, but if you have this this likelihood of this thing happening, what are you basing this on? Well, I've done this and that and that, and that's cool, but what about source evaluation? Mm-hmm. And they were like, source what now? Information evaluation, you know, information what now? And then we got into this whole discussion of what is actually your decision or your analysis based on? What is your structure? What have you made sure? Have you made sure that your analysis and your conclusion is built on sound and proven intelligence processes? Are you tracking your sources? Are you analyzing your sources? I mean, everyone knows that a log in an incident can be changed. So have you even contemplated the fact that, you know, you read your logs and you see no trace of XYZ happening because you can't see it in the logs? And I said, well, can logs be changed? And I was, yeah, they can. Okay, cool. So maybe that changes your assessment? No. Well, why not? Well, the logs, you know, it's not in the logs. I'm like, okay. So we have to go back into the whole, let's break this down really, really slowly for you. So, you know, the people in the back can understand that. You have to have control of all your data. You have to track all your sources. You have to assess your sources. Yeah. So when you go online and you find someone writing something on Twitter and you take that data as truth, you haven't done good analysis because you have to analyze the data. You have to find multiple independent sources for you to say that it's likely or highly likely with a set confidence level. Yeah. So those are the discussions and questions I got into, and that sort of frustrated me into this sense of I started to be, I would say, a little rough on vendors when they started to say, well, we have all this cyber threat intelligence, it's amazing. I was like, yeah, that's cool, but you don't know me and my requirements. And when I get the question of requirements what, then, you know, I already knew that this vendor was, you know, smoke and mirrors, that this sales rep didn't know what he or she was talking about. So because if you're going to sell me threat intelligence, you need to know and tag me as a stakeholder. I have requirements. Then you're going to show me what are the products you are going to give me that are answering my questions, that are helping me my decisions. Yeah. So that's the framework. And that's where it all started, I think, in late last year when I was speaking with really knowledgeable people. And we were all agreeing that, you know, there's a gap here. And we're all talking the talk, we're not walking the walk. Someone should build a mind map. So in January, I sort of threw something together and started reaching out to industry experts. And, you know, it started growing, and we discussed and walked through the mind map step by step, and they helped me build it, basically. So this is a community-driven, I would say, or at least the resource of using the community as a resource to build the mind map to the size it is today. And today it's huge. It's a monstrosity of a thing, but it's my baby, and I love it.
That's amazing. And can I also ask, because I know in the academic literature there's also a lot of information and a lot of articles about intelligence and specific, you know, areas within intelligence, really interesting articles. And it always fascinates me how much there is, you know, to discuss and talk about. And oftentimes, you know, people tend to forget that there's so much more to just OSINT. This is what I meant earlier with just the tools. It's more than that. Of course, they are very important. And as you described it, and when I saw your Intel architecture map, I was just, wow, really stunned by the level of details. You know what I'm going to try? So for our podcast listeners, unfortunately, you can't see what I'm going to show. But maybe if you can explain it, so our listeners can also kind of like visualize it. Mm-hmm. And I will also try to now share my screen. So hopefully it works. Share screen.
Yeah, so while you do that, the map in itself is built on the intelligence cycle. An intelligence cycle is depending on who you look for, and online you can find multiple versions of it. I follow the NATO standard. It has four steps. But at the same time, I'm basically adding two steps that a lot of people talk about and then quickly move past. And I'll mention them when we get into the view of it. But basically, I use six steps, the four steps of the intel cycle, how to produce intelligence, while the two other steps I'm going to talk about in addition, that's basically how to manage and how to improve your whole intelligence program. Now, another thing I would like to say when you see the map is that the map is huge and it's detailed, as Laurent just said. The idea is not for you to implement everything. This is a good discussion point of where you say, I'm going to take a little bit here and a little bit there, and this is my process. I am one person. I can't do it all. I'm just going to take the low-hanging fruit and build my own program and do the best I can. Or you're a large organization. You have multiple departments. And in those departments, you have multiple functions, and then you have to build a bigger program. And perhaps in that sense, you will have to do more, and you take more elements of all of it and build into your program. And then you want to grow and mature. And that means you can actually grow and take more elements into your program.
So
this is the map. Yeah. So this is going to be difficult to follow, definitely. So if we can start on the top right-hand corner, that would be great. So as I said, the top two elements to me on the right-hand corner first is intelligence management. Now, intelligence management, that's not about management of your company. That's management of the intelligence program as a whole. So over the year, over the next 2 years, you are going to build or deliver intelligence. What the intelligence management part does, it helps you structure and help you identify, who are your stakeholders? What is the process of identifying your stakeholders? And that's sort of the mini circle you see up there in the right-hand corner right now, where you identify your stakeholders, you identify who they are, you're figuring out what they care about, you start planning how are you going to engage with them over the year, are you going to have informal by the coffee machine talks, are you going to call them, are you going to have formal meetings, whatever it is, you need to figuring out how you're going to approach this, and then go back as a circle. And every year you sit down with them and say, over the last year, we have given you product and service XYZ. Have they met your expectations? Mm-hmm. If yes, great. How can we improve? If no, what can we do to fix it? And then how can we improve? So that's basically the whole intelligence management or engagement. Wow. I think it's the right word.
Yeah.
So once you know who your stakeholders are, you need to go through your resources, figuring out what all the requirements to all your stakeholders are. You need to build out a map. What are the products and services we have to build? What type of analysis do we need to do? And then, what type of collection and data we need to do those analysis. Mm. And once you know all these things, you can start setting the expectation management. Basically, your stakeholders want you to deliver something, and in their head, they already know or think they know what they want. But given the time, given the quality, and given the resources, you can only do half or maybe one third of what they were asking or at what type of quality they expect. So you set yourself up for success here. Over the time, they're going to give you a lot of money. They're going to give you budgets. And if they think that they're not giving value, then they're going to turn around and ask you, or even worse, they're going to cut your budget. And that's probably going to be even worse. So understanding who your stakeholders are, building the whole program. And if you scroll down at the bottom of the red section where it now, there you go. There now you see where you build your program. And then also you set up the maturity development over time. You say, well, we're going to start easy this year. Next year, we're going to grow with and expanding with these functions, these people, this technology. And we're going to build up these sources and develop our program over the year. So that's basically the top right hand corner. That's the intelligence management side.
Wow, it's very, very detailed and so much that goes into it.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, but and also for someone who is new to the field of OSINT, this might scare someone. But I think, I mean, to be honest, like I'm not familiar with a lot of these things because it just never came across, or I haven't, or I had to do it. But just being aware of it also helps quite a lot. So
absolutely,
that's the whole OSINT or the intelligence cycle is just much more than, you know, just to report on a tweet or on an event. That goes so much into it. Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, when you get into the whole, how are you going to produce intelligence? That's where usually most of the people are, right? So I have this thing I want to figure out. If it's a personal thing you want to figure out, or if someone asks you, basically you just dive right in and just you go to your normal sources and you try to figure this out, and you write a tweet or you write a blog or you write an email, right? And then you're done. And that's the low hanging fruit. That's the easy part of it. And if you, I guess a lot of us have had that situation where, and me included, where I have produced intelligence that someone never read, or they got it, read it, and were upset because it didn't help them. It didn't give them the value they were looking for. So what this does is it's basically helping you understand that there's a bigger process involved, where if you follow these steps, you are actually making sure that you're setting yourself up for success and you can start deliver. Now, the second step in my mind map, which is the first in intelligence cycle, is direction. Now, direction is about how you're setting yourself, how you're setting up this specific delivery. So while the first one was how to manage the whole program, this in direction is how you're setting the direction for this production. So if you're going to write a specific report, or you know you have to call someone with some information, or write a tweet for all I know, basically that's sort of the end goal of what you try to do. Now, the first step in this section here is all about the dialogue. You have a question from someone, a stakeholder you know, they ask you a question, and then you, instead of turning around just running, you need to sit down and spend 5 minutes and say, you're asking me these things. You know, it's what's up with Russia these days? Or, you know, what's North Korea up to these days? That's an impossible question to answer with, you know, you and I, we're not part of intelligence community. We don't have all these resources behind us. We need to sit down and say, well, that's a little difficult to answer in 4 days or 2 days or 2 hours. But if we could discuss more about what is it that you actually worried about? Well, I have this organization, we have some vulnerabilities, and we hear about this exchange vulnerability out there. People are trying to exploit a vulnerability in on-prem exchange instances. We are afraid that we have protected ourselves, but who are they? Who are after us? And you know, what can we expect if they start hammering on our door? Well, that's actually narrowing it down that, well, we all know that this happened in January. That was the exchange vulnerability. And a lot of people are saying it was China that was behind it. And many groups within China was actively trying to exploit vulnerabilities in exchange on-prem. So that's narrowing it down quite a bit. That dialogue helps you focus your work. And so you don't dive into rabbit holes and try to figure out stuff that's not relevant to the question you're trying to answer. So that's basically I'm simplifying massively here, but that's what direction is all about.
Yeah.
Figuring out what the stakeholder really wants so you can focus your scarce resources and your time so you can write a good answer that's actually in the right direction, pun intended, to the question you want to answer.
I think that's also a great tip for OSINT people, for those who do it like as a hobby and also for fun at the weekend, myself included, is to ask these questions. And if you feel like it's too broad, to really narrow it down, because the questions will guide you eventually. I mean, at the beginning for me, I remember there are times, and it sometimes happens as well, that I come across an interesting profile, and then I spend a considerable amount of time on just looking through a profile just because something is of interest. But then I remind myself, what are you looking for actually? And then it's just, you get dragged away easily, and then you end up in this rabbit hole, and then it's difficult to just stop and then ask again, what are you actually looking for? So
That's awesome. I've spent hours and days and weeks on nonsense at times. Yeah. I'm the first person to admit I've done these things as well.
Yeah.
Before I understood, you know, hang on, my manager is getting upset now. Why is that? And I had to go in internally myself and figuring out, well, I might need to structure myself a little bit. And that's, that's helped me immensely. So, you know, in that dialogue box at the top of the on direction, basically, that's where we figure out who is asking for what. And then we discuss and figuring out all our requirements. And usually when we look at the requirements, we say, I have all this data available to me. I know a lot of stuff already. We have institutionalized information, or we as a team know something, or I know something. That means I look at my requirements. Some things I can give answers on right away and I ship it right away. And some things I don't have answers to because I need to go out and collect. And that's the gap analysis. That's what's giving you direction for what is it that you need to collect. So that means you can then start diving and drilling into your intelligence requirements and develop them specifically of, you know, what do I know, what, you know, the known knowns, the known unknowns, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can actually try to tag, you know, what type of products will be perfect to convey the information to that stakeholder that will help him or her to make the decision. Did they ask for a presentation? Is it a combination of a presentation and a report? Do they want the technical details or just the facts? I don't know. So those are the things that we also need to cover in that dialogue.
Yeah.
And that basically will go through what type of analysis do we need to do? What type of collection do we need to do? And some sort of tracking of everything you do. So if you're using Excel sheet, we'll never get away from Excel sheet. I think that's an important thing. You know, we use an Excel sheet, or we use some sort of software that manages it. There's a company that has a software that helps you do this. It's called D3i Intelligence. I think they just renamed and rebrand, so I'm just going to be a little careful on that name now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, tracking your requirements, tracking your collection plans, your production plans, your dissemination tracking, your vendor tracking, your source tracking. It's really important to start track this, because over time you will see some sort sources or some vendors are not as valuable as you first thought, because either you read it and you don't trust it, or you don't use those vendors or those paid services as much as you thought. You might think about, canceling that subscription, or using restructuring your internal funding so you don't have to spend $1 million on this vendor if you don't use it. And the data, you can basically find it online, and you spend 2 hours every week to build that same data set. Well, you're going to save a fortune. So direction, setting up who's doing what, where are we going to do it, by which time, etc. That's the direction part of it.
Nice. And then we move into
collection. So collection, this is where you find in a traditional intelligence process, and in my mind map, this is also where we find OSINT as a source, but we'll get into it. So the first stage here, when you start the actual collection based on, you know, the overall structure of your program, what is it that our stakeholders are expecting from us over the year, and then direction, what is it that they want us to do right now, and what do they want us to focus on, and that's the intelligence collection plan. That's basically the background and justification of what you're doing, your basic int minus your knowledge, i.e. your gaps, what is it that you're collecting and why. And then, of course, you create an activity plan. I am going to go there and get that. I'm going to go here and go and grab that. And then I'm going to combine the two, which hopefully will give me answers to some of these things that will give me direction to go here and there and another place. So, you create your draft of what you're going to do. And especially if you're more than one people, this is also a golden opportunity for you to say, I'm taking these four tasks, you do these three tasks, and Peter over there are going to do those five tasks. And then we have a huddle or a scrum every 5 hours, and then we sort of pull our data in, and then we reconvene and say, what do we now know? What are we missing? And then retask each other, and then go out and work more towards our goal. So that having that understanding and a little plan of how are you going to approach and attack sort of the the problem. And that leads me into a really important function, and that's the collection manager. Having someone with an overview, someone that sees the bigger picture, I think that's so important, especially when you're more than one person. One of you should take charge. One should have the bigger picture. One should say, we have these things now. You don't have to go there. I have already been there, and Peter was there yesterday, and Louise was there this morning. Mm. That shouldn't happen, guys. We should be making sure that we're not wasting time. Yeah. So once we have a collection plan, we actually go out and look at our sources. And I made a pretty, you know, first of all, this mind map is towards cybersecurity minded people. So that means, you know, it's geared toward it. So internal sources to me is all the internal investigations we have done. It's our solutions that gives us data, logging, mm-hmm. our apps and programs, of course, and also the And external to me is everything I have to buy, stuff I have to go outside of my own shop to get. Mm-hmm. So if I have to go online, that's an external source to me, and that's where I have put OSINT. So though I use OSINT for many things, but you know, anything I own and control, my logs, my computers, my data sets, that's me, that's internal. Anything I have to go outside of my own shop to get, to me, that's external. And you know, I have vendors, I have cooperative networks, etc. Mm. And this is in sources also where you look at your source reliability and source relevance and also bias identification, because let's face it, you and I and all of us, we love certain sources. We love to use a certain tool, but those sources and tools give us a skewed image. So we need to be careful of not always going down the same path to get that data. We need to try different paths, challenge our way of working, and try to new technology, try new sources, work together with other people who can teach you other ways to do the same things you do.
That's absolutely important. As you said, biases and even being aware of it is extremely important, especially in the analysis section. I think we also talked in previous episodes about intelligence analysis and the different biases. And I think there's even a map out there I found says it lists over 180 cognitive biases that exist. It's really interesting to learn about this.
Yeah, so I've only included a small portion of it. So, we're not going to spend time on that today. I don't think we have time, to be honest. And so, so basically, what you learn when you go through the mind map, I always go through my resources. Mm. Do I have the process and plan in place of how I'm going to do a collection analysis? Do you have the people with the right skills? Are they available? Can I actually use them? Are they on holiday? Are they at work? Whatever the case might be. And then the technology of doing collection. Oh, yeah. The technology, of course, is all about, do I have the tracking system and ticketing system of who's doing what? Do I have systems to help me with collection? So I guess all of us know Hunchly or Intel Owl. You know, there's automatic or semi-automatic systems that helps us gather data and track and trace who gathered data from which sources at what time, what was the data they gathered, what was the link, what was the metadata of the data, what was the date and time. I already said that, but still, you know, all those things are really, really helpful when are going to store the data, and especially when we do analysis or for law enforcement delivery, when we deliver info packages to law enforcement. So, of course, once we're done with our collection and we need to start processing. So a lot of people think processing is a separate step. Well, in my world, when I talk about this, when you do collection, you do processing as you collect. You start looking at the data, and then you go back to collect again, and then you look at the data, and you go collecting more. You start pivoting off of the data, and then you collect some more, and then that opens up new avenues, and you test those avenues, if it makes sense to your question. So basically, you start some semi-processing in the collection stage, where you normalize your data, you enrich your data, you structure and deduplicate data, and then you see, hey, this is interesting, I need to go get some more data. Yeah. So it's a semi-processing, semi-analysis part in collection. And that's what I think, and this is just my sort of, I know I'm going to hurt a lot of feelings here, but I think that's what most OSINT analysts who hasn't trained properly think is analysis. That's usually where they stop and go, okay, now I have all this data, I'm done. I have this beautiful map of everything I did. You know, this is tracking the known network of this person, and you know, and I'm happy, it's beautiful. But the actual analysis is all about doing a rigorous analysis, and that's the next step of the mind map, where you get into the actual processing stage, which is down in the left-hand corner, where you actually get into processing and some call analysis stage, and it's a huge green monster, and that's by design, because is where you have all your intelligence processing and analysis stages of structuring all the data, putting them into models like, you know, MITRE model, diamond model, kill chain. And now again, I'm talking about this from the cyber element.
Yeah.
And you do certain stages. Now, collation is all about putting, collation to me is like the analogy, if you ever played with Lego, you have yellow pieces and blue pieces. Yeah. You have some pieces that are small with only two heads on it. Some are with four heads on it. Some have just one row of heads. Some have two row of heads. All of those things is about categorization, grouping, selecting the relevant data you need. And then you jump into the evaluation part. And that's basically, you know, and this is actually a really difficult. And actually, if you don't do it well, this is where most of the time you do intelligence failures, where you're putting together data and saying, you know, because of this, you know, causation isn't, I'm messing up this phrase now, correlation isn't causation or whatever it is. I'm sorry, I should do this in Norwegian. So once you do the collation part, you basically go into evaluation. That's where you critically evaluate all your data, all your sources, all your information, and then you also look at the initial deception detection. I know all this data, but has this data been tampered with? Who has something to gain for me to find this data right now? And you know, how can this skew and change my perception or change my view and my conclusion? So having that, taking that time to discuss with your partner and your colleagues is really a good way of making sure that you're not being tricked, or you know, someone's not doing false information, which is, you know, really in everyone's mind these days.
Because
now analysis. Yeah, sorry.
No, I think that this is a really interesting topic, and I think I can't remember where exactly I read it, but there was also, you know, 2 weeks ago, I think it was The Economist published an article specifically on the topic of open source intelligence, and I think with the article, it must be in the minds of many millions of people. Like, it reached a wide audience, and many people already know about OSINT, but it's also about, you know, everyone knows that OSINT is being used against states or individuals. So you can also use OSINT to deceive people. And I think this is, I have no idea, maybe there are some even articles about this that research these topics. And but I would be really interested in reading about these instances where people deliberately put out things that are fake or were faked, so someone else, you know, geolocates it and then comes to the conclusion that this is the place, so that's why it was person X or something, you know, trying to use OSINT against or in support of something. Which I find very interesting. Have you
Bellingcat? Bellingcat does that quite well, I think. And there's other sources that Bellingcat links to where they're actually ripping apart a narrative from a government, and they are actually ripping that apart and going back and backtracking everything that government has said, and showing, you know, pictures and logs and satellite photos that, you know, basically it says the government is lying. And I totally agree. You know, that's really good craftsmanship of doing open source.
But also, very recent example in Afghanistan around the airport in Kabul, I saw on Twitter a First Draft News, so an organization that that teaches a lot of journalists worldwide how to, you know, do research and digital methods. Really great stuff. And one of the researchers wrote a Twitter thread, and he or she, I can't remember, discovered that a lot of snaps were uploaded onto SnapMap deliberately around the airport of Kabul that showed gaming content. And this was, so goes the argument, that, you know, to flood SnapMap with irrelevant content
and this can be done. It didn't conclude who it was or whatever, but this is another example. I mean, if we just look at how much work goes into this, into producing, you know, intelligence, and if you just flood one of these with or bombard them with information, then this is already a big problem that we have so many sources and, you know, quintillion of bytes are produced every day to go through everything and then to just on purpose put out stuff there. So someone has to go through it. It's very, very challenging, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And you know, having multiple sources that will help you. Well, first, if you have one source you're using and it gets flooded, how you deal with that flooding and filter data and categorize the data, the Lego pieces I talked about here previously, automating that process, because it's going to be a humongous task for people to do, but automating it and getting machine learning in there to help you figuring out what the real data is from all the noise. Yeah. That's going to be imperative there. And also having multiple sources that you can pull off and say, this data from all that garbage data is actually matching other sources we have. And then you can correlate the data So those are two, I would say, good avenues. Yeah. So in going back into the mind map in analysis, this is where you do all your structured analytical techniques. Now, we could spend hours and hours talking about this. A great company called Globalytica, run by Mr. Randy Fearson. He's sort of the godfather of how to do structured analytical techniques. He has written many books on it. You know, I would really go out there and try and figuring out where you can do an online course and train on how to do structured analytical analysis, basically.
Yeah.
So, and here you also have mapped. You don't have to show it there, but I've tried to map all the different techniques that they're teaching tied to all the different biases. So if you know that you and your team or your organization or your group has a certain set of bias, you can start identifying what bias you have and then use the appropriate analytical techniques that will help you reduce those biases. They will not remove them. They will help you reduce them. So you can actually make sure that you structure your analysis and try to take out the biases and only look at the data and what it tells you.
Yeah.
So that's a really important part of the analysis process. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of people are missing this step, either, you know, by chance or, you know, not because they don't want to. It's just we all have biases. We all have hindsight. We all have, you know, recency bias and all the things that are popping up lively that are really images usually, and video is more lively and more into our biases than text, for instance. So all of these things play into how we structure our analysis and also our conclusion, I would say. So another step that's also missed, I would say, is the production part of it. That's also in part of processing. Now, I think this is a fair point to where I want to point out that even though I'm going step by step by step, everything here happens almost at the same time. You know, you collect some data and you get some questions, you check in your head or your logs, what you have, you already have some data, you start analyzing that data while you're doing collection, you gather more data, you do more analysis, you structure that data, you analyze that data, and you figure out more data comes in, and you continue data. As you're doing data and analysis and logging, that's basically the start of your product, and you're basically producing as you're working. So it's not a slave, you know, waterfall step by step by step. It's basically everything goes into everything, and it's a fluid process, I would say. Now, production is everything in the production part is tied into the stakeholder. You need to make sure that you're meeting intelligence requirements with this product and actually making sure that the stakeholder can take it. So if you write a huge 50-page technical run through of all the beautiful things you did, while the stakeholder is the CEO of the company, he or she is not going to be happy. The person basically needs, should I do this or that? That's it. What is your advice? Well, that basically means that you have to do what's called a bluff, bottom line up front, or what people usually call an executive summary. And that basically, that's where you have your 2 minutes of fame. This is what we think. This is what we think happened. This is what we think will happen. These are the things that we base this on. This is our conclusion. These are the main drivers. These are also our assumptions. And you have to make clear where you are uncertain, where you are certain. So if you do this, you have successfully helped the stakeholder, and they will trust you and come back to you for more for future reference. We don't have to go too deep into the production side, but basically this is helping you structuring your thought process as you're going into that stage.
And then after the production, we move on to?
Dissemination. Yeah. And that's the beautiful part of where you're actually going to show your stuff. So, and again, you know, doing it half-heartedly, that's not a good idea. So basically what I say is, again, we go through our resources at the top. We say we have all these processes in place to help us do a good dissemination. We have the right people with the right skill sets to do it. And then we have the technology to help us. And then we create, again, a plan, a dissemination plan. Mm-hmm. And basically that's AIMS. AIMS, Americans love their acronyms. I love it too now because, you know, it helps me structure everything here. But AIMS is audience, issue, message, and storyline. Mm-hmm. So the audience is your stakeholders, those that are going to read your product, those you are presenting to, those who are going to use and make a decision. That's your audience. And you need to make sure that whatever you do and produce, it has to be adapted to them and their needs. If you're, again, writing a 50-page product of how cool you were because you did all these amazing things, that's for everyone else. That's for OSINT people. That's not for your stakeholder, usually. You might have a really cool person or educated, trained, I would say, OSINT person at the helm or your stakeholder, then that's cool if they ask for it. But usually that's an attachment, not the product itself. And of course, the issue is the topic, the thing they're asking for. The message is what you're saying and how you're conveying that message, and the storyline, of course, telling a story. And that's so important. And that was also part of the production stage. We skipped a little past right now.
Yeah.
So once you have the AIMS ready, you need to have some sort of actionability. Can they use this force to make decisions? Is it timely? Is it relevant? Is it accurate? Is it consumable? And is it tailored to their needs? Acronym again, TRACT. But you'll see that when you get into the mind map. So once you're done with the plan, you start looking at and diving more into your recipients. Again, I have focused on cyber. So this is more about, you know, the cyber defense center, the white team, the blue team, the red team, the SOC. But also added, you know, insider threat, HR, PR, directors of managers, C-suite, the board, the shareholders, etc. That's all your internal. External might be, you know, government entities, vendors, the sector, industry, collaborative networks, etc., whatever that might be. And then, of course, you have to deliver it. And that's delivery type. I usually divide it into delivery type and delivery format. The type is, am I delivering it to you? Am I giving it to Rand and then he delivers it to you? Mm-hmm. So am I doing it directly or through some third party or liaison? Or am I doing it through a collaborative workspace? Am I using a database or some API where I can share the data through MISP or whatever it is? In terms of format, the format is the product. Is it a physical product or a digital product? Mm-hmm. Is it through phone? Is it through a messaging service, email? Do I do a briefing? Is it a newsletter, blog, etc.? Whatever it is, that's the format of how you're delivering your message. Now, the next part, and I think that's also something that most people don't understand, is the delivery variants. What that means is sometimes you have to do a presentation and a physical product. Sometimes you present something on screen, which is digital on a PowerPoint, but you also want the people to have a product in their hands, which they can flip back and forth with, take notes on, and mark important sections on if they want to. Some customers want that. other environments, they have tablets. Everything is digital, but they have a report where, as an attachment, they can download and read if they want to, and they can follow your presentation on screen on the tablet, which is, again, a combination. I have to do a presentation, and then I have to call two people, and then I have to send everything through the API. You know, it's everything depends, so the variance is also something you need to take into account here. Cadence, of course, is how often are you delivering your off-the-shelf products. So I have a yearly generic threat landscape report. I write a 100-page report that summarizes the threat landscape for the Nordics. I also do quarterly threat assessment reports that writes and summarizes everything that's happened in the last 3 months, what happened, what are our assessments of it. And then I also do daily, weekly, monthly updates of our daily radar, weekly radar, etc. Stuff we are working on continuously. So all our stakeholders always know what we're working on, and they can start asking us questions. I see you're now working on SolarWinds. How does that affect us? How can this affect us in the future? How do we defend our supply chain for the future? What can we do to reduce that threat to our risk in the future? Those are typical questions I received in January, where all the SolarWinds thing ran over Christmas. Yeah. So these are typical things that you're going to get asked, and giving them a good mind map of all the cool things you did on OSINT is not going to impress them and not going to help them. So you need to think a little higher level, basically. So once you're done with your delivery, you can start looking at classifications and restrictions. Not every people should know everything. So the media perhaps shouldn't know everything you tell your employees. Yeah. The employees probably shouldn't know everything your department knows. Your department shouldn't probably know everything that your board of directors know. So there's different levels to take into consideration. So sometimes you do a presentation, the presentations was geared towards your board of directors, but they have included or invited members of the media. Then you have to really be on your toes on what you're saying. Having those things in mind is really important.
Yeah.
Now, another point which gets us soon into the last step is enabling metrics. So already here, and also in the production side, you also need to think about how can we make sure that we can get feedback on our products, on our presentation, and we need to make it as easy as possible to get that really valuable feedback, because at the end of the day, if our stakeholders aren't happy, well, they're not going to ask us, or they're going to look at us with disdain because, they're paying all this money for our services, and we're not providing the value that we think we are, and they're not happy. And that's not a good place to be in. So making sure that you enable them to give you metrics is really important.
Yeah.
And the last step I would say here is really important as well, and that's the integration. Once you're done with the publication of your data, you need to integrate it into your knowledge space. So it's now ingrained in your institution or in your group or in your knowledge. So it's easy to retrieve for you and your team or for your organization for future questions. And that goes back to what we said in direction. You have questions, you have your existing intelligence, and whatever remains are your gaps.
Wow.
So this is a mouthful. So I'm just going to power through the last one. And that's the second point I made in an introduction, which usually isn't part of the intelligence cycle. In most cases, people talk about feedback. They talk about the value of feedback. And basically, that's also really important. But this is where you have the ability to learn. So if you sit down and have a heartfelt over the coffee or even a beer with your most important stakeholders, and they tell you, hey, that report you produced last week, it was great, but, and now you need to listen, right? So however, if you were to do this, and if you were to add that, and if you were to change that graphic in that way and give it as a table and also as attachment as a CSV, I can actually use that data in my presentation to my stakeholders. Ah, that's a learning process you need to take in and ingrain and start changing. The next time you deliver something to this stakeholder, you know now that that person wants it in a table and also want that table as a CSV file as an attachment. That's a key thing for that person to be happy with you and your services and the product you deliver next time around. And that's basically the, you know, the gist of feedback.
Yeah.
Getting that feedback from them, helping them. I call it illicit feedback. You know, you can't sit back on your chair and wait for that phone call or wait for that email.
Yeah.
They're not going to do it. You have to chase the feedback. You have to actively go out and get it. And you actually have to actively be proactive and also then actively integrate that changes as long as it's within your budgets and in your ability. Because if it's not within your budget, guess what? You got to go back to stage one, intelligence management, and you talk to those who give you money. You guys want me to expand on these things. I need another full-time employee, or I need this technology, or I need to send my guys on this type of training for me to be able to do that for you at the level you want. So this is, you know, completing the circle.
Yeah.
Helping you help your managers and your stakeholders improve the entire program so you can actually be better the next time around, the better next year, you know, developing and, you know, growing as an organization, producing intelligence. Whew, that's powerful.
So once again, to our listeners, let me show you again where you can access the map. So first of all, thanks so much for giving us this very detailed walkthrough. So you can check out the mind map on his GitHub page. So it's github.com/EWRUM/Intel Architecture Map. And so I mean, there's so much in it, and I think we can talk forever about it, but I really appreciate you taking the time and walking us through here. And I mean, certainly for me, like, I've learned again a lot, and this is what I like about these interviews. And you can see like how much goes into it. And we at Awesome Curious, we talked about the intelligence cycle before, and I mean, not really in detail, but we explained that there's a process going on, and, you know, there's certainly work involved and there are challenges, but this one gives really a good, and I would say a very practical perspective of, you know, creating intelligence and what everything, what you actually need and everything that comes with it. Especially what I found very interesting was and very important as well, the intelligence management. So before you even start getting, you know, the requirements, and I think this is also more for those in managerial positions, but it's also very important to understand for the analyst as well, because they can certainly also help as well. And then you walked us through the direction, collection, processing and analysis, dissemination, and everything that comes with it. I mean, this was certainly a really, really in-depth and also well explained. So thank you very much for this.
You're welcome. And it shows, as I said in the introduction, right? It's really complex. Mm. It's not just let's do something, slap something together. Actually, if you want to do intelligence well, this might be a first starting point where you nitpick a little bit and build your own low-hanging fruit starting point, and you can grow and expand. And it certainly helps me quite a bit, because my mind, at least, is messy. I have all these things going on, but following a structure helps me structure and be more focused when I work.
Yeah.
So hopefully this will help more people.
Yeah, absolutely. It certainly helped me as well. Like lots of things, and gave me new ideas. And I mean, that was really, really good. Thanks for that. And I think also for our listeners, especially those that are new to this field, I think one massive takeaway, certainly one that I take away, is that, you know, how important the structure is. If before you jump on any tools or anything, to just think through the entire process of everything that you want to do, and be critical in also evaluating, as you said, sources and the information itself, but also how you present this. And I think for those who like to publish blog posts and tweets, I mean, I certainly do this as well when I write a blog post. I haven't done one in a while though, but thinking about who you write it for, like the writing style. And this is also something that I want to improve as well and learn more about, because writing is very essential and so important in the OSINT world, and also how you communicate this. And of course, as you also highlighted, there are many other products, but how you present it, because at the end of the day, you want someone to do something with the information and not just have it there. I mean, it's cool, you know, if people read it and say, wow, thank you. But yeah, you want to have some impact with it. So thank you so much for this again. And before we wrap up this interview, there's one last question we ask every interview, and that is, what's the next thing you want to learn?
Oh, the next thing I want to learn is basically working with risk. Mm-hmm. I think that I need to be better at communicating with those who are using my intelligence the most, and that's the risk department.
Yeah.
Let's face it, you know, the risk department talks with the board of the directors and the managers and the mm-hmm. C-suite. They present the risk. They present also the measures, all the items they have to work on to improve, to reduce the risk.
Yeah.
And my input to them is my threat intelligence. My intelligence is what they use as input to understand the threat landscape, and what the threat is part of the risk equation. I want to learn more about risk and work more on the risk terminology so I can speak their language more effectively. Just like you said, writing a blog post, who am I writing for? Who are my key readers, and how can I influence and help them understand better the actual threat, and they can then calculate the actual risk. I think that's for me at least my biggest thing I want to learn the remainder of this year.
Yeah, the remainder. Nice. Then good luck with this, and hopefully you can share some interesting insights from that experience. And also for those, are you still working on the intelligence architecture map? Are you looking for contributors or interviews? Or
oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, so I'm still working on it. It's on version 0.7.24 or something right now, so it's growing slowly. Yeah. So if anyone has, you know, experiences and think, you know, I'm doing something that I could do differently or better, or hey, have you thought about expanding this to that level, or why haven't you done this instead of that? I love to do those discussions. My ego is at the door. I don't care. I just want to talk about the skills and not about people. You know, discussion is about what's right. Arguments is about who is wrong. I don't do arguments. I do discussion. So yes, if anyone out there has, you know, really good ideas or just a idea, contact me on the Discord. My name is Ferdy, F-U-R-D-Y, and you'll see it anyway. Or just ask Seven, and you'll find me there.
Awesome. And you just mentioned the Discord server. So we recently rebranded. So that's our Ozen Curious Discord now. And you can reach out to Ferdy, F-U-R-D-Y. And you can reach out to him on there. And hopefully you join us as well. You can find the Discord server link to our show notes. But I think the website is iamozencurious.com/Discord. I think that's the invite link. So if I'm mistaken, sorry for this, but you will find it in the show notes, definitely. And with that said, thanks again so much, Freddy, for joining us today and sharing your expertise and insights. So that was certainly amazing, and I really enjoyed it. And so thanks for joining us. And also to our listeners, thank you so much. If you have any ideas for future episodes or any suggestions, please reach out to us and let us know. And also make sure to like and share this video if you liked it. So thank you so much.